4195, Little Lomas versus Nevada Joint Security Department. We are the yard and panel of the Supreme Court, Justice Chris Pickering on my right, Justice James Hardesty from my left, to my left. And what I'd ask is, we have the UNLV future paralegals of Clark County here with us, with Mark instructor and Mark.
I'm again.
Here you are. Thank you for bringing the class
Thank
here.
Thank you for having me.
And what I'll ask is, what we usually do when we're in the lawyers, if the attorneys could just briefly tell the audience what the case is about, spend a minute or a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes max, is what your case is about, and then that you want to tell us about the rules and the rules about the audience. Go ahead and introduce yourself too, please.
Hi, I'm Matt Malone, attorney with Jones Vargas. I represent Appellant Alfonso Villalobos. I was appointed pro bono for representing this case. Mr. Villalobos was denied unemployment benefits on the basis that he was discharged from his last employment for misconduct. We believe that the evidence doesn't support that there was misconduct that was originally discharged at his last employment. Accordingly, the employer didn't show up at the hearing and provided no admissible evidence of testimony as to why he was discharged or that the discharge was in violation of policy. And the statute here we're primarily talking about is NRS 612-385. So we're going to determine whether or not the standard was met to find misconduct under that statute, and if not, what benefit Mr. Villalobos would be entitled to.
Good morning. My name is Tom Susan. I'm a senior at the Naval Security in Nevada from the Security Division. I'm here representing the division with regard to Villalobos' case. This case is somewhat unusual, and it contains a rather interesting legal argument, which has to do with whether the burden of proof or how the burden of proof applies in the evidentiary proceedings in this case. One of the things I will be arguing is that there is sufficient evidence in the record of relevant to be able to reasonably conclude that Mr. Villalobos was guilty of misconduct when he was terminated from his job, and therefore under state and federal law, he is not entitled to termination.
Thank you to both counsel for those presentations to the paralegals. I'm sure that now I better understand the law right now. And Mr. Malone?
Yes.
It's very distracting what you're doing with these monitors. If you just stop.
Apologize, we've lost our connection.
May it please the court, Matthew Malone, Jones Vargas, on behalf of the appellant. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In this court's decision in Buckley, one of the important points that was made is that unemployment benefits are a safety net. They're a safety net provided to the working population of Nevada. And that safety net doesn't exist in all cases. The safety net, as you said in Buckley, doesn't exist where an employee voluntarily leaves their employment without good cause. One of the other instances it doesn't exist is where an employee is discharged for misconduct. Now, ultimately, this is a question of fairness. What is necessary to show that my client, Mr. Villalobos, was in fact discharged for misconduct? In Buckley, this court looked at first the definition of misconduct, which is disregard or knowing disregard for a reasonable policy or standard of the employer. And this court said that there needs to be a separate and distinct inquiry into whether or not there was a policy, whether that policy would give rise to termination, and whether or not the employee was in fact terminated for violation of such a reasonable policy. In this case, there's a total absence of evidence, there's substantial evidence, which is the standard, supporting that Mr. Villalobos was fired for violating a reasonable policy. There's not even evidence that there was a policy. In fact, the employer never provided a policy or standard to the division. They didn't testify that there was an unwritten policy because they didn't show up. And not only did they not show up, they didn't provide any sworn statements, affidavits, or any other evidence about why Mr. Villalobos was terminated or that he was terminated for violating a policy.
Well, he testified at that hearing, is that correct?
He did testify at the hearing, Your Honor.
Is it possible that the performance pretty could have isolated benefits just on the basis of the the employee's testimony without the employer having to show up?
Well, I think there's in Bundley, what was stated is that there's a two-step process. First, the employer shows up and demonstrates that there was a policy, the policy was violated, and that's the reason for termination. At that point, the burden shifts to the employee to rebut that and show that they weren't, in fact, terminated for violation of the policy. Now, in certain instances, maybe there's a potential that if the policy had been established and the employee admits being terminated in violation of that policy, there could be isolated instances where that would apply. But this is not one of those instances. My client, Mr. Villalobos, simply testified that he was incarcerated. He didn't know the reasons for exactly why he was terminated.
Well, wasn't it no call, no show?
That's an interesting point, Your Honor. There's two things in the record, and they contradict. The employer submitted two documents. Document one, which was the office manager, who was actually Mr. Villalobos' direct report, said he was separated from his employment because he couldn't do the job. And the employer sent then an HR person from another HR person from Mentoring of America's last employer sent a form in that says no call, no show. And those are in the record, I believe, at 813 and 878.
But if he was incarcerated, how could he go to work?
He couldn't go to work if he was incarcerated, but there's no evidence in the record that is the reason that Mentoring of America actually terminated Mr. Villalobos. There's actually no evidence that he missed a shift. There's no evidence that the policy of Mentoring America is you missed one shift or no call, that you would get terminated. If there was a policy in the record that says you miss one call, you call, don't call in, and this is in Bundley or in some of the other cases, the Kraft case that was cited, I believe, cited by the division. If there's a policy that says you miss one call or you wouldn't shift without a call, you're terminated, that would be a different case.
Would it be sufficient? Short of the employer actually showing up, if the employer had provided a written policy to ESD that here's your policy and he violated it?
Right, I think if the employer, I think that in Bundley, the employer had the burden. Now, there's nothing in Bundley that said the employer actually has to be present to meet that burden, but the employer has to provide some evidence. If you're going to deny Mr. Villalobos his benefits, which are provided by Nevada law, there has to be something there that gives rise to the denial of benefits. There has to be the employer meeting that burden. If we were in a case where the employer submitted a sworn letter or an affidavit saying this is our policy, Mr. Villalobos violated this policy, Mr. Villalobos was terminated for violating this policy, then it's on Mr. Villalobos to rebut that.
So you're not taking the extreme position that the employer must show up at every one of these hearings and provide live testimony?
No, I'm not taking that position. I'm taking the position that they need to establish these underlying grounds for termination if the benefits are going to be denied. One of the arguments that the division raises is that this case is different than Bundley because in Bundley the employer is challenging the benefits. Well, I think that brings us to an interesting question as to why didn't the Employment Security Division ever get to this point? Mentoring of America never said that Mr. Villalobos was fired at this time or for denial of or violating a policy. Like in Bundley, where the Clark County School District did say that Ms. Bundley was terminated for violating a policy. The previous employer, whose benefits would be paid here, they didn't come in and say, well, Mr. Villalobos was fired for misconduct from his next employment for Mentoring of America, where he worked for less than a week. There was no one at any point alleged that he was fired for misconduct until the Employment Security Division issued their decision.
Mr. Moon, so you're not really arguing that there's a fault for the failure of the employer to show up rather than there's a void in the proof?
Yes, well, what I'm saying is that there is a failure to meet the burden. And the burden can be met by in this case, the employer had notice, could have shown up. In fact, the employer was called and didn't return the calls from the Employment Security Division.
Right. And as I understand your argument, or essentially the argument, is the burden of proof sequencing occurs in Bundley. My concern is whether that sequencing is at odds with federal regulations referenced by the division in their briefs, where here, based on that argument, that the sequencing made place in Nevada's federal employment system for state kind of planning system in jeopardy with federal regulations. What's your view about that?
I disagree that there's a violation of federal regulations here. My reading of those regulations is that the Employment Security Division can't give out benefits where they're not wanted. That they can't just, someone comes in and they can't, as you said, Your Honor, a default. But that's not what we're talking about here. Every state, and in Bundley, there's case law stated from Montana, there's case law cited from Utah, from Wyoming, from all these states that have established, other than Nevada, that have established a similar system. But really what this comes down to is whether or not there's substantial evidence to support it or not.
So you're saying that the burden sequencing in Bundley is not inconsistent with the regulations, just that the regulations permit the division to accept all reasonable evidence that this court rejects the decision?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's the reasonable position I think we're trying to take in this case. When I say that there's no automatic default, it's not simply that someone doesn't show up. The fact is, when the employer did show up in this particular case, there was no other evidence for the division to rely on.
There was the initial report that said he was a no-call no-show.
But that no-call no-show report conflicts with the other reports submitted by the employer that he was terminated or he was separated from employment because he couldn't do the job. How, if the employer submits two conflicting pieces of evidence, how the burden that there was a policy, that he violated that policy, and that policy gave rise to termination, how can Mr. Villalobos ever come back in and rebut that?
And my understanding is that the division asked the employer to reconcile those positions, and the employer did not respond.
Right, they did not return the call. They refused to return the division's call. They didn't show up. Probably because they didn't feel like this was worthwhile, and they didn't ever raise the argument that he was terminated for misconduct.
And he was without a lawyer at that hearing.
He was without a lawyer until this appeal.
Well, could you, following up on what Justice Hardesty is asking, and it really goes to the heart of the matter here, the regulation in question discusses what the state agency must do to meet Department of Labor criteria, and it says, the state agency is required to obtain promptly and prior to determination such facts pertaining thereto as will be reasonably sufficient. Goes on, but then it says it is the responsibility of the agency to take the initiative in discovering information. This responsibility may not be passed on to the claimant or the employer.
Well,
so where do we go with Bundley and that regulation and these facts?
Right. Well, I think that what that's saying is the agency has a duty to go out and obtain the necessary information. But the agency did that in this case. It went in order to do that. It went out to the employer and said, why was he terminated? Got back to the conflicting reasons. Went back and said, can you reconcile? The employer refused to do it. Went to Mr. Villalobos. As stated in Bundley, the employee doesn't always have the reason for why he was terminated. Mr. Villalobos says, all I know is I was incarcerated. I got out, and then I was terminated.
Is that language I was just excerpting for you consistent with Bundley and its burden shifting?
I think it is. Because the Bundley isn't shifting, Bundley isn't taking the burden off the division to go out and obtain evidence. What Bundley is saying, in obtaining evidence, the division needs to first go to the employer. If you're going to deny benefits under NRS 612.385, if you're going to deny somebody the safety net, and you need to have a separate and distinct inquiry, is what Bundley says. And that separate and distinct inquiry is the division going out and obtaining evidence of what their policy, what was the policy, did the employee violate the policy, and was the employee discharged by violation of the policy. And all Bundley's saying is you have to do that first before you go back to the employee and say, you need to prove your case for benefit. So in fact, I think Bundley's Act is very consistent with those regulations because before putting the entire burden on the employee to show that he wasn't discharged from misconduct, which in many cases would be an impossible task, it's forcing the division to first go out and get the evidence from the employer to show that these elements were met.
So your position, Mr. Wong, would be that the division made an attempt to contact the employer to reconcile the conflicts that existed in the evidence grounds for your client's termination that satisfied its requirements
I think it satisfied the requirements under the regulations, but I don't think it satisfied the standard in bundling for denial of benefits or finding this time.
Should it have all agreed with your position? Should it direct your client's benefits, or should it remand for further proceedings on this matter?
Well, I think that there should be a limited remand. I think that there should be a finding and a ruling of this court that Mr. Villalobos wasn't terminated for misconduct. Because at this point, it's been Mr. Villalobos has gone without benefits for 3 years. He's not in a financial situation. And to go back and look through this entire process again, I think it's important considering what his wages were. I think that we could remand it to determine what exactly those payments should be and how much the benefit should be calculated at.
But at the end of the day, the panel could be in the position should direct the against benefits only be in this question.
Yes, Your Honor. The administrative record has been completed. If there was any further discovery that needed to be done, it should have been done at that time.
We have about 2 minutes left so that the paralegal moves in. If appellate, that's the party that lost the lower court, wants to reserve some time, they can file a reply brief, which counsel did, that they can reserve some time to have rebuttal. So this is on behalf of the public security.
Yes, Your Honor, Jay Thomas Sears is on behalf of the public security division. As the court has, through its questions, indicated, this case has mainly to do with bundling and unbundling, you have to say. I agree with counsel that there is a presumption that all persons who are rendered unemployed in the state of Nevada are presumed to be entitled to unemployment insurance benefits. However, the system also provides that there has to be a method by which an agency such as the Nevada Employment Security Division can determine whether or not that person was involuntarily unemployed. If he was voluntarily unemployed, that is, he caused his unemployment, he is, as a matter of law, not entitled to unemployment insurance benefits. I think the court has indicated, and I would reinforce, that I do not believe that Dunblade indicates that this is some sort of contested case, like a murder case in front of the jury. This, in fact, is an inquiry that is conducted by the agency for the purpose of determining eligibility for benefits. And not only under federal regulations, but under NRS 612.500, the administrative tribunal is charged with developing all issues and admitting all evidence, regardless of the rules, the statutory and common law rules of evidence, and must determine eligibility based upon all of the evidence presented. Given that fact, when one looks at the facts of this case, counsel is correct that the evidence was, in many cases, inconsistent. But that is not at all uncommon in any case, and especially in an unemployment insurance case.
What bothers me is we have somebody denied benefits for no call, no show, and then we have an employer who doesn't return a call, who doesn't show. So, I mean, is fairness coming in this at all?
Well, I think that the issue here is not a matter of whether or not the employer runs or the claimant. The issue here is whether or not the claimant is entitled to benefits under the state federal law. And that is a different inquiry. This is not a contested case in the classic sense of the employer wins or claimant wins. It's a determination of entitlement. And in this case, I believe that the evidence does establish that Mr. Villalobos was guilty of this conduct and was not entitled to benefits. For instance, the employer did provide evidence at the agency level that Mr. Villalobos was terminated for a no-call, no-show. And in fact, Mr. Villalobos, when he testified before the referee, confirmed that. He confirmed that he was supposed to show up for work, I believe, on the 22nd of July, 2008, that he was arrested for apparently passing a bad bill at a service station, that there was no evidence that he made any attempt to contact his employer to notify the employer where he was or what was going on with him. He did not show up for work the next day when he was supposed to show up for work. And in fact, testimony indicates that he did not show up for work for several days thereafter. Mr. Villalobos testified fairly clearly that he was released on the 23rd of July. And there is, in fact, several locations in the record where he indicates that that was the situation. But the evidence indicates that he certainly did not show up for work until the very least, the 26th of July, and probably the 28th of July, which means that he was out of jail, was actually on the streets from the 23rd through at least the 26th of July, and at no point during that period of time did he contact his employer, tell his employer where he was. The evidence indicates that the employer did report on page 78 of the record to the agency that Mr. Villalobos was terminated for a no-call, no-show. If you look there and it says reason for termination, it says no-call, no-show. There's also been a great deal made of agency. Yes, that's page 78 of the record.
Right. What is the document? Is that a phone call or is that?
That is, what happens, Your Honor, is that when a claim is filed by a claimant and there's an initial examination of the claim by an adjudicator who's an employee or an administrator, if it looks like there's something about the claim that's suspicious, a document, this document, which appears on page 78, is sent to the employee. And it basically says, you're the next last employer, or the last employer, and there's been a claim filed. Will you please explain when this individual worked, and whether and why he was separated from the employer?
Well, if I understand the record correctly, Ms. Cole, lettering of America's office manager, indicated that the termination that Villalobos quit on July 21st because he stated he could not do his job. And then Ms. Maria Montoya, responding to the claim form you're talking about at page 78, admitted that he was discharged because he was no call, no show. So the division had reported, the hearing officer had reported, two conflicting reasons from the same source. The state then attempted to clarify what was the deal, did he quit or did he fire? The company did not respond. So, in evaluating whether there's substantial evidence to support the determination, it seems like the information from the employer, at least, is conflicting, and without any other information or evidence that can be pointed to, except for Bill Lowe's testimony, to support one over the other. Do you agree with that characterization of the record?
Well, I would agree that there does appear in the record at some point there evidence that the employer, that somebody in the employer's office responded to a request for welfare that was filed by Mr. Villalobos, and that person indicated that Mr. Villalobos had quit. The evidence, though, that is directly related to the unemployment insurance plan is page 78, which is the response from the employer as to the reason for his separation from employment. And it clearly says he was terminated for no call, no show. If you look at the welfare department, say a document, which is page 124, it is a little bit confusing, but if you look at it, you will see that it says fired, quit, and then it got down 11-27-07, and it says did not return for a new assignment, which would indicate he didn't show up to work. So I'm not so sure that wasn't just written on the wrong line. But furthermore, once the the agency has information.
Well, that's a different form. This is Cole's response.
That's right.
This is Cole's response is an earnings verification form, where she clearly states he stated he could not do his job.
Yeah. Okay, but if you look at the testimony that was developed at the time of the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Villalobos made it very clear, well, not at the evidentiary hearing, but at the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Villalobos made it clear that he did not return. And that is why his separation occurred. Later,
The point I was about to get to is sure that wanting to characterize the record gets to this burden shifting approach in funding. I think we'd all agree that Bundley has indicated that it is necessary for the employer to demonstrate a burden that overcomes the presumption that employees are entitled to compensation, either statutorily or under federal regulations, if one. Has the employer satisfied that burden? In this case, without regard to the rule of necessity.
Well, I believe if you look at the case in its totality, okay, they have.
The Bundley case or this case?
The Villalobos case.
Okay.
Okay, if you look at the case.
So you're suggesting that the referee can look at the Villalobos testimony?
They can look at the view. Of course, the court. In fact, the referee has to. Under NRS 612-500, the referee must bill all issues, regardless of common law and other statutory rules of evidence. Otherwise, the inquiry that is established by NRS 612-500, which applies to federal law, would be meaningless. Mr. Villalobos would just have to appeal. And again, counsel says, well, he did appeal the case, but that doesn't mean anything. He could just show up at the hearing, apparently, and just stand there. And if asked, well, tell me why you were no longer working for the employer, he could say, I hereby invoke my right to not answer the question. And therefore, under the Bundley case, I'm entitled to benefits because I have no burden of proof. I do not have to answer your questions. But he did answer the questions, and I think rightly so. He's required to under 500. And he answered the questions and clearly explained why he was no longer working. He then, when he appeared before the Board of Review, submitted a written explanation as to his termination. And there he stated, after the evidentiary, that he did in fact not show up for work, that he did then go back to work on the 28th of April. And when he went back to work, he was supposedly offered a job and declined the job. So that's where this quitting argument comes in. He says, so I didn't get fired, I quit. The Board of Review and the referee.
Well, the problem with that response from the record is that occurred on July 28th. Ms. Cole's response is she had dated to my first so I'm concerned about that.
Well, I agree with you. And part of the problem in these types of cases is that they are convoluted, they're confusing. The job of the referee and the Board of Review is to try to ferret through the conflicting information and arrive at a decision of eligibility.
Could you explain your view that Bundley somehow requires a clarification or as a result of federal regulation requiring the division to conduct its own
Well, because I think that the Bundley case as it's written, and I indicate, again, looking at the context of Bundley and understand why it was written the way it was. But the Bundley case, based on its facts, is very different than this case. And I think what has happened is that a lot of people are out there taking a position that if the employer does not come in and actively contest that the claimant should have been by default. I think that's a
that's not real. The local is present in this case. I just clarified that.
Well, I know. I understand that now. I wasn't clear about that before the license.
You were making the assumption.
Right. And of course, Dudley isn't in the vacuum in this case. It's arguing quite a bit in the lower.
You're seeing the agency level cases.
The state board has a clarify.
Well, I think that Dudley actually is relatively clear to read it in the context of the case. I believe that in a situation like Dudley, where the employer, after a determination by the administrator that the individual is in violation, that it is incumbent upon the employer, who is the appellant, to appear at the hearing and to present some evidence to rebut the decision of the administrator. But I think the same thing applies to the claimant who is appealing from the determination of ineligibility. Now, I understand the reasoning in that the employer tends to have more information with regard to the reasons for the separation. And I do understand that. And it's very important and valuable to have the employer present in order to develop the record. But in many cases, the employers are not present.
So would you say that Bundley is being pressed into dual service inappropriately, that the burden on the employer should only apply in the setting of an employer appeal? And when you discuss actual burden of proof, it isn't really the employer that must show the burden of proof, but rather the agency that must gather enough facts to demonstrate the existence of misconduct, at which point the employer must come forward with evidence to refute that. Would that be a better reading of Bundley?
In my opinion, it would. And I realize my time is up. One thing I also want to point out is,
maybe give him
a minute. Yeah,
please. Yeah, I appreciate that. Is that at page 80 of the record, Mr. Villalobos clearly testified that he was aware of the policy for no calling. He testified that the policy was, in fact, that he had to report his intended absence in advance of the beginning of his shift. So the argument that there was no policy in this case that forbids such conduct, this is proof of record.
But to follow up on my question, does the burden shifting at the point of the initial determination suggest competitive adversarial positions by the employer and the employee that are foreign to this setting? And is that what you're saying is the flaw in Bundley, although it may not be the particular flaw in this case?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Is that the thing that you have to understand is that the way the system is set up is that it is an inquiry by the agency who is in charge of making a decision as to eligibility. It is not a contest between the employer and the employer.
But if the employer fails to give any information and the employee says nothing, the default goes to the employee.
That's true. But if the employee shows up and testifies, yes, I did in fact not show up for work, that evidence must be considered by the administrative tribunal under 5 NRS 12500 in federal regulations to determine the eligibility.
Now, Mr. Susie, what would be your outcome on this? Mr. Villalobos eyes for benefits, and he shows up here. The employer does not respond to the claims. And during the course of the hearing, he's asked, did you show up for work? And he says, I was incarcerated, as I believe the claims in this case, and the charges were false. And that's the record. He's not the benefits.
Well, the problem is that I would say you probably didn't have it. In that incarceration under Evans, where there's no indication of guilt, does not disqualify those.
Which leads me to a concern I have at this record, and I want to clarify this for me before. My understanding is that the referee, in deciding this case, indicated that part of the reason for giving this stuff was
Phil knows his knowledge that he gave that information, but he didn't ask, he was unavailable for the Do you say that?
Yes, and I think that's a correct interpretation of the law. What Lutch was saying is that while he was in jail, he was not eligible for benefits because he's not available to work. And that would apply for anybody that's in jail, even if they're in jail and not guilty, because they're not able to work. That's a requirement of the law. But his eligibility would then, once he got out of jail, be reestablished because he then would be eligible for work. What happened here?
But I guess that's why the referee made that finding, because what was at issue is what happened when he didn't show up for work.
Right.
They were testing his eligibility as a date.
Right. It started when he was incarcerated, but once he was released, then they also found him guilty of misconduct, which made him ineligible and felt he was reemployed. And that's the period for which I think he's
so the referee didn't use that statement as the basis for denying eligibility for the first instance.
She didn't use his unavailability beyond the week for a period of time that he was in jail, which I think was actually one day. Okay. Thank you.
I'll give you a full 3 minutes. After 1 minute, 3 seconds. If you want to get started.
The idea here that the burden, the regulations require the division to do fact finding, I think, does not conflict at all with Buckley and doesn't conflict at all with what we're arguing in this case. There's certain divisions entitled to do fact finding, but if the employer's facts don't establish a policy that was violated, then it's not onto the division to then step up and say, well, there must have been misconduct simply because he was in jail. Or simply because he may not have been able to show up for a shift. There's a leap in logic here that's inconsistent with both bundling and the federal regulations. Because essentially what the division is doing is saying the employer's testimony conflicts. The employer is not showing up to resolve that conflict, is not submitting anything to resolve that conflict. So, and the employer has never said, never claimed that he was fired for misconduct. Even in the 878, even the no call, no show, it doesn't say that that was in violation of a policy. There's no policy that's provided. It doesn't say our policies terminate people for that. People, it just says it didn't show up for work, which conflicts with the Ms. Cole statement. Without that evidence, how does the division then take the leap in logic that he was terminated, Mr. Villalobos was terminated for misconduct? Which they're essentially doing at that point is doing with the regulations and Buckley forbid, which is putting it on the employee who really doesn't know the reasons for termination to step up and prove that he wasn't terminated for misconduct, to prove a negative, when the misconduct has never been established. I mean, misconduct can only be established, as you rightly said, bluntly, where there's a policy that's violated. The employer at least has to step up, and I'm not saying they have to provide a policy manual, but someone at least needs to step forward and say, we have a policy that if you call, you don't show up for work, if you don't call in, then that's grounds for termination. That's completely absent from this record.
And actually, you know, the reading of Bundley, that the employee need not show up and need not respond to questions is a bit troubling because the employee, who's often unrepresented, will show up and be disadvantaged by providing the evidence against himself. It's going to doom his claim to benefits in a way that's a...
From a due process standpoint, it would be an unfair situation to say the employer has a burden to establish a policy violation of that policy, but if you show up and you testify because you don't know you have the right not to, then we're going to deny you benefits. But in this case, Mr. Villalobos did say he was incarcerated. He did say that made him unable to call into work, but that he didn't know, and he isn't saying the record, he knows that's why he was terminated. And the employer doesn't step in and say, yes, that's terminated, and doesn't take the additional step of saying, and that was a violation of our policy. And given those facts, there's just not enough here to deny.
The courts recognize that no call, no show is the basis for termination, not a policy. The issue here is whether or not operating under the federal regulations of Mr. Sousa's that the division is in this situation, and that it can obtain evidence equally from the employer and the employee to resolve the question. Is he a no-call, no-show? In this case, it appears that Mr. Villalobos' testimony supplied a reconciliation of the conflict in the employer's response.
I don't think it did. Mr. Villalobos doesn't say I was terminated for no-call, no-show. He said, if you read the testimony, the sworn testimony, at 824 through 853, he simply said, I was incarcerated and I couldn't call my work. And now, counsel points out LK80, but I have a lot of questions about that document. It doesn't appear, because it's not signed by Mr. Villalobos, there's no sworn statement. It appears to be someone from the division's interpretation of what Mr. Villalobos was saying. And there's nothing in the record when you look at the testimony of the recorded testimony that he took under oath. Does he say no call, no show? He doesn't resolve that that's why he was terminated. He didn't. All he said is that he was incarcerated, and that incarceration has not been established to be the reason he was terminated for his job. So I don't think the regulations don't allow the division to put the burden. Its burden to do discovery on the claimant or the employer, but it also doesn't allow the division to go out and say, we're going to deny you the safety net of benefits, the presumption of benefits, where the employer has provided no evidence of the reasons of your termination. That presumption should stand for the employee in favor of benefits, where there's no evidence that you violated the policy or was actually terminated for no fault.
I have one further question. Could you comment on your opposing colleague's argument that the statement by Mrs. Cole that on July 21st that Villalobos stated he was no longer working there because he couldn't do this job, that was not a statement that was made in the context of the Employment Security Department records, but rather a welfare application. Is that correct?
I mean, it was in the welfare application form, but it was in the administrative record before the commission. So I think it had to be considered as part of the evidence.
And other than that statement by Mrs. Cole, was there any conflict as to the grounds for the termination being no-called, no-show?
Well, Mr. Villalobos never testified that he was terminated for no call, no show. And I believe, although it's not the administrative record, before the district court, later submitted a statement saying that they were asking him to engage in conduct he didn't agree with.
I understand that. But I mean, other than the statement by Mrs. Cole in the welfare record, is there anything that says the reason for him no longer working there was that he stated he could no longer do the job?
No, that would be the evidence.
So that's the source of the conflict with the no call, no show.
Yeah, well, if you're looking at the employer's burden is to establish the reason for termination. The employer submitted three statements, and they, one says he said he couldn't do the job. It's not clear whether he's quit or terminated because they did a bracket around all three. And the second statement said that he was terminated for no call, no show. And the third statement was the one on A-124 that counsel referenced that somewhere in between and stated he couldn't do the job, so he didn't show up. And so I guess our feeling is, how can that establish the employer's burden under bundling?
Well, thank you both for your arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter stands submitted.